Welcome to Module 4 of the High Performance Instructional Leadership Certification Program. In this module, we're going to get very specific about how to see the whole iceberg of teacher practice. As we've seen, much of teacher practice remains hidden beneath the surface, and there's limited value in focusing only on the observable teaching behaviors we see when we visit a classroom. Psychologists Joseph Luft and Harrington Ingram observed that there are four categories of information about ourselves. First, there's the open quadrant, which contains information that's visible both to ourselves and to others. Second, there's the blind quadrant, which contains information that we haven't noticed about ourselves, but that's visible to others. Third, there's the hidden quadrant, which contains information that we know about ourselves, but choose not to reveal to others. And finally, there's the unknown quadrant, which contains information that neither we ourselves nor others realize about us. Luft and Ingram called this framework the Johari window, and it's a useful tool for thinking about how we can see the whole iceberg of teacher practice. Often, when we get into classrooms, we find it helpful to share what we can see that the teacher can't, the blind quadrant. For example, if you overhear a group of students talking while they're working and the teacher doesn't, you'll know something that the teacher doesn't, and you can share it. At the most basic level, we can serve as another set of eyes and help teachers see their own practice more clearly. Of course, video can do the same thing, and I think as leaders, we can add a lot more value than simply holding up a mirror to teacher practice. As we've seen throughout this program, conversation can allow us to gain a deep understanding of teacher practice. And by using all three types of feedback, directive, reflective, and reflexive, we can walk away from these conversations with powerful insights about what it takes to improve at the individual and school levels. So join me as we explore learning dynamics, the patterns of cause and effect that are at the heart of teacher practice. In this module, you'll see clips from real teachers' classrooms, and I'll model for you how I look for those patterns and how I talk about them with teachers, including questions that I ask and the evidence that I share. So let's get started. I'm Justin Bader, and I'll see you in the next section. If we want to understand teacher practice at a deep level, it's essential to figure out what the teacher is trying to accomplish with any particular instructional activity that we might happen to observe. This might sound obvious, but often we do the opposite. We visit a classroom and we pay attention to the strategies the teacher's using, but we look at those strategies in the abstract. Are they the best strategies? Are they being done the best way? And those are important questions, but we can't answer either of them without knowing what purpose the teacher is trying to achieve by using those strategies. So there are two main points at which it's essential for us to seek out the teacher's purpose. The first is while we're observing. We should be able to get some sense of the purpose of the lesson or the activity just from sitting in the classroom. A quick note of caution here, though. Often the purpose of a lesson or activity is multifaceted, and what teachers share with students isn't always the ultimate purpose. So if a teacher has a particular objective or a purpose statement or an essential question written on the board, just know there might be more to it than meets the eye. For example, as a science teacher, I learned how to plan inquiry-based lessons that were intended to be a little bit of a mystery to students. They'd get enough information to get started, but if I told them the real purpose of the lesson and the standards it was intended to teach, it would have ruined the inquiry aspect entirely. If you were once a classroom teacher, your expectations for how teachers communicate the purpose of a lesson to students depend on what you taught and at what grade levels. For example, if you were a high school math teacher, you might have relished the activities that gave students the experience of figuring out a geometry formula empirically, for example, like the Pythagorean theorem. But if you told them in advance, today you're going to measure a bunch of triangles so that you can see that the Pythagorean theorem is correct, that probably would have ruined the lesson, right? And if you were a kindergarten teacher, you know that often the content you're teaching, for example, the picture book that you read to the class, is just a vehicle for what you're really trying to teach, such as social skills or reading comprehension skills. So if you ask students, what are you learning about today? They might say Franklin the Turtle, which of course isn't really what they're learning, but that's okay. We don't want students to be confused about what they're supposed to do, but depending on the subject and the grade level, it's okay if the teacher's real goals for the lesson aren't 100% clear to students. So again, the first opportunity to seek out the teacher's purpose is while you're observing, while you're sitting in the classroom alongside students. And you might find it helpful to take on students' perspective. What are they thinking the purpose of this lesson is? How are they making sense of it? And then the second opportunity to inquire about the teacher's purpose is when you're having a conversation with the teacher. And of course, you can ask directly, what were your goals for this lesson? What were your teaching objectives? But you may also want to consider framing that as a question of context, and ask something like, could you talk to me about how this lesson fits within the larger scope of the unit? Or what has this class been working on and what did you want them to accomplish today? If you ask too narrow a question, you're likely to hear something that you already know, like the purpose of this lesson is to give students practice with using the Pythagorean theorem. Well, if you saw the lesson, you already know that. So how can you see more of the iceberg of teacher practice? The exact phrasing of your questions doesn't matter all that much. What matters is that you inquire, that you seek first to understand the teacher's instructional purpose, their goals for the lesson. Only then can you start to understand what you saw and give effective feedback. We'll talk more about how to have these conversations throughout the rest of this module, but for now, I'd like you to give it a try. The next time you're observing in a classroom, try to figure out what the teacher's goals for the lesson are. Consider the aspects that are clear to students, as well as any deeper purposes that the teacher might have in mind. Then, talk with the teacher directly and inquire about those goals. If you can, try this right now and use the form below to share your thinking. Compare what you thought the teacher's goals were based on what you observed with what the teacher said his or her goals were, as well as anything else you picked up from the conversation. I'm Justin Bader, and I'll see you in the next section. In this section, we're going to look at a clip from Karen's fourth grade classroom in Massachusetts. I asked Karen to send me this video without any context to simulate an informal classroom visit. So I haven't seen the lesson plan, I haven't seen the unit plan, and because this is an elementary classroom, I'm not even sure what subject this is. So go with me now into Karen's classroom, and we're going to just listen for about 4 minutes.
What I want you to do, you ready? What I want you to do is I want you to look at each of these shoes. This is Timmy Churchy's shoe. This is my flip-flop.
Oh, your old flip-flop.
And this is another shoe.
That's
so I want you to look at them and I want you to notice what makes them different, what makes them the same. Chat. So their size. So they are different in terms of their size. What else, Keaton?
One looks really different. The flip flop, it looks different. It's flat, unlike the other shoes, and it doesn't really have the difference between those two shoes and that shoe. That one is more flat, and it's built for like walking somewhere, not really on a surface from stone or pavement, because it could like accidentally fall off. Those are more built for outside or inside. That one's mainly for inside.
Okay, and can I restate what you just said? Is that okay? Mm-hmm. So what Caden is saying is this one's built more for outside. I think I heard Cole say for sand, potentially. Whereas these two are built more for if you need a little bit more support. Would you agree? Put your thumb up if you agree.
Yeah.
Remember to
make
it. Lily Hagberg, you had your hand up. What do you notice? They're all different colors. Carol Ann?
The sandal does not have
like a front? Yeah. It doesn't have like a roof, right? It's just open, right? Where these are covered to keep your feet protected, maybe? Jacqueline? They're all shoes. Lacey? Thomas? Awesome. Danny, did you want to add something?
Do you want different symbols? Golden.
remember that if you want to add something, what am I looking for you to do?
Raise your hand.
Berlin's notices. These might be the same brand, Christian, but they definitely have different symbols. This guy has the Nike Jordan guy, whereas this one has the Nike swoosh, but they're still the same brand. And this is a totally random flip-flop.
Average.
Okay, so what are you thinking Karen's goals are for this lesson? I'm not aware of any curriculum or standards that cover different types of shoes, so I'm thinking that maybe this is part of a writing lesson. Students are gathered together on the rug, and there's a piece of chart paper with three columns on it, and those columns say too big, too small, and perfect fit. She had students describe the different shoes, and she paraphrased what they said, and that's about all we've seen so far. So 4 minutes in, I don't really know what this lesson is about yet. I don't think she's teaching the concept of bigger and smaller and the idea of comparisons, because that's not a fourth grade topic, it's too basic, yet that's what she's talking about. So already we can see the activity and the goal aren't exactly the same. She's doing this for a reason, but I don't know what it is yet. So let's continue.
The three little bears, right? This is too big, this is too small, this is just right. So let's, for a moment, start thinking about what do you think a book that is too big, right, that doesn't fit. What do you think that looks like? Think about the book, think about, what can you brainstorm? Cole.
So like, there's a big book, and you're like in a library, and like, you can't put the book somewhere.
So you think that a book that's too big has too many pages or too much text?
And also like a really big or too big.
Well, that's a very literal interpretation of what I'm saying, where the book is too big. What I mean is the book doesn't fit because maybe it's too challenging or complicated. So what would a book that's too hard for you, Hannah, what would it look like? So Cole said, maybe it simply has too many words, right? Raise your hand if you've ever been in a situation where you're reading and you're like, holy cow, this book is really long, and I don't know that I can finish it, and I'm overwhelmed. Okay, so I'm going to call this too much text, which actually means too many words. It's just too overwhelming and too much. What's another characteristic, Caden, of a book that would be too challenging for you?
I think a book that's too big for me would be like, well, hard words that I never heard before.
Excellent.
And they're really long, and a book that it makes me like, it's like so hard to even read. All the characters' names are hard to remember.
Okay, so now it's become clear that she's using shoes that are too big or too small as a metaphor to help students understand the idea of a perfect fit book. And in this second clip, she has students start to describe what it looks like when a book is too big or too advanced for them. And you heard her clarify that even big is a metaphor. It's not that the book's physical dimensions are too big, but perhaps that the words are too hard or there's too much text. All right, let's go on to the third and final clip from Karen's classroom.
You just need to identify whether or not on your chart it is a perfect fit. So go through the steps.
Miss Schofield?
Yes.
I put books in my bin that I thought were perfect books, so if I take them out and see.
Absolutely. Those are not necessarily going to be just right books for you.
Oh, you mean chapter books? Like chapter books?
So keep looking. Hannah.
Yeah?
Are you doing your test to find out if you have a just right book?
Well, I finished one book and finished one page. Now I'm on another page.
Okay.
But I didn't read this one yet.
Okay, so don't forget to do your...
Excuse me, got me this book.
Don't forget to do your checklist. Mm-hmm. That looks like a good book. Hmm? So that book is too easy? Okay, so Chad, So that's good. So you would identify that book as too easy and keep looking, okay? Yes.
While I'm doing this, these look like all chapter books.
Okay, so get your chart of how to find a perfect fit. Sit down and practice. How are you guys doing over here? Cooper, which books have you chosen? Okay. Did you take your chart, take your paper, and go through the steps of identifying if it's a just perfect fit for you, okay?
This is like the lamest book.
Christian, that's not going to be a just right book for you?
Yeah. I have no idea.
No, you were just checking it out.
Okay. So, Lacey, are you practicing? Where's your chart?
Okay,
pick your third book.
Are you going to put this on the card job?
This one's so good. It's about a dog and the evil rabbit. And a cat. A dog.
How are you doing,
Chelsea?
Running away from a bunny.
I found a teacher.
I forget how to
check us. Okay, so I'm seeing now that students have a rubric or a checklist that they're going through to find a just right book. And I noticed that a lot of kids are looking at books that they found appealing for some reason, but Karen keeps referring them to their rubric to make sure they're looking at the criteria and not just the cover of the book to figure out if it's a fit. So later on in this module, you'll see my conversation with Karen, and I'll have the chance to ask her some different questions that get at her goals for this lesson. For example, one thing I don't know right now is how far she wanted students to get with this. Did she want them to look at several books and go through the checklist to see if they were a perfect fit? Or did she want them to just pick one book to read, and if it was a perfect fit, stop there? Whether the lesson was successful or not will depend entirely on what happened for students relative to those goals. And while there's always room for improvement, we want to make sure that any improvement opportunities we talk about are either directly linked to those goals or are so big and important that they shouldn't be overlooked. At this point, it's useful to think about what kinds of feedback we might plan to engage in. If I have something that's not related to Karen's goals, but I think it's a big deal, I might want to take a more directive approach. For example, if there's a student who's sitting behind a bookshelf where Karen can't see him during the lesson, and that student is off task, that's in that blind quadrant of the Johari window. It's something I can see as the observer, but Karen can't see, in this case literally because he's out of her line of sight. It's no use asking reflective questions to get Karen to try to figure that out, so a coaching approach is probably going to feel a little patronizing. I can just tell her, hey, you had one kid who was sitting behind the bookshelf and wasn't paying attention, and then I probably don't need to give any advice from there. If I'm direct in sharing what I saw, that's enough. Once I know Karen's goals for the lesson, though, I can think about taking a coaching approach and asking reflective questions. Right now, since I don't really know what her goals are, I'm not quite ready to do that, but I'll figure that out during our conversation. Finally, what about reflexive feedback? As you recall from Module 3, reflexive feedback is bi-directional. I'm listening as well as talking, and Karen is giving me feedback too, so I can be an effective leader. So we might talk about things like, say, classroom libraries, because as you saw, for this lesson to work, it's essential to have a big classroom library with books at different levels. And Karen does, so it's not an issue for her. But what about her colleagues? Do we have any new teachers who don't have a big classroom library? Now, personally, I worked in a school where classroom libraries were purchased by the district, so teachers didn't have to scrounge around or buy their own books. But if I'm new to Karen's district, I might bring that assumption with me. And this reflexive feedback conversation with Karen may be my first chance to realize that classroom libraries need to be on my radar. So we can always use reflexive feedback, and sometimes we can choose to use directive or reflective feedback too. But we always want to interpret what we see through the lens of the teacher's goals. And we can do that both while we're observing and in our conversation with the teacher. For now, I'd like to have your feedback. What were you thinking as you saw each of the three clips from Karen's lesson? What were your thoughts about Karen's instructional purpose or goals for the lesson? And how did that change as you saw more of the lesson? Use the form below to let me know. I'm Justin Bader, and I'll see you in the next section. How can we depersonalize our feedback so it doesn't trigger teachers' defensiveness quite so much? If we don't understand the universal patterns of cause and effect, we'll often default to blame. Blame is the most straightforward explanation for what's taking place in the classroom, but it's usually an oversimplification. Blame is counterproductive because teachers are generally doing what they believe is the best they can do. If we attribute or blame what we see in the classroom on some inherent characteristic of the teacher, we're limiting the opportunities for growth, not just for struggling teachers, but for great teachers too. To change their practice, teachers have to see a new possibility. But if there's an opportunity for improvement that they haven't taken advantage of yet, if they could be doing better but aren't, that creates a sense of tension and guilt. To resolve it, we have to have someone to blame, and usually we only have a few options. We can blame ourselves, and the best teachers usually do blame themselves. They know there's always room to grow, and they take responsibility for getting better. But if teachers fear that they're going to suffer professional consequences by taking responsibility, they won't. If I say, "Yeah, I'm really not that good with classroom management, I need to get a lot better," to my boss, there's a very real risk that my boss might agree and get rid of me rather than help me get better. So teachers understandably look for someone else to blame. They'll blame students or parents or you or policymakers or the economy or anyone else but themselves, and this takes away their sense of agency, their sense that they can improve. And this puts us in an adversarial relationship. If we see ways the teacher could do better, and the teacher doesn't want to be saddled with that responsibility and admit that they could be doing better, we have to pick a fight. We have to poke a hole in their armor and make the case that, yes, they could be doing better. Teachers understandably take this personally, as an attack on their professional identity. They can play the blame game too, making excuses for themselves by blaming others. Regardless of who's doing it, blame is counterproductive. But what if there were another way? What if we didn't have to get teachers to admit personal failure in order to see opportunities for improvement? What if, instead of blaming the teacher, we could blame something outside of the teacher for the results we're seeing? If we can depersonalize practice and focus our feedback on those patterns rather than on blaming the teacher, it's much, much easier for teachers to take risks and try new things without feeling threatened. But we fall into blame-based thinking far too easily. For example, if I see a lesson that's really working well and the students are learning a ton, the simplest explanation that requires the least thinking on my part is to blame that success on how great the teacher is. But of course, that teacher is not effective because of some inherent quality called greatness. Effectiveness comes from how the teacher thinks and acts, and we can be much more specific if we know what to look for. Being aware of these universal patterns or learning dynamics can help us avoid committing what psychologists call the fundamental attribution error. Fundamental attribution error, in layman's terms, is our tendency to attribute what we see other people doing to who they are, to immutable traits, rather than specific circumstances and patterns. For example, if I see a lesson that's not going well, there's some reason for that, and as we've illustrated with the iceberg metaphor, the reason is likely hidden beneath the surface. Let's say in this case it's a planning issue. If I want to help the teacher improve, we can focus on more effective planning. But if I commit the fundamental attribution error and just think, "Well, this lesson is terrible because this person's an idiot," then I'm not going to take the right actions to improve that situation. I'm just going to blame the teacher. So if blame is too simple an explanation for what we're seeing in the classroom, what are some better explanations? Here are four key learning dynamics. Number one, amplifying feedback loops. Number two, dampening feedback loops. Number three, delayed reactions. And number four, side effects. There are more, but these four patterns cover a lot of what you'll see in the classroom, and when you learn to describe teacher practice using these four patterns, you'll find that your feedback is a lot less personal and a lot more impactful. In separate sections, I'll go into a lot more detail on each of these dynamics, and I'll give you specific examples of how they play out in terms of classroom management. For now, I want to leave you with a warning sign that you should stop and look for learning dynamics. Anytime you hear excuses or blaming, that's a sure sign that there's a better explanation hiding just beneath the surface. Don't let yourself or your teachers off the hook with simple explanations based on blame or excuses. Look deeper. Look for the universal patterns. I'm Justin Bader, and I'll see you in the next section where we'll begin exploring some of the most common learning dynamics. I'll give you some examples focusing on classroom management, and I'll highlight some of the major implications of these four patterns for our work as instructional leaders. What is an amplifying feedback loop? An amplifying feedback loop is a cause and effect relationship between two things that amplify or accelerate each other. For example, let's say there's a lot of side talking going on while the teacher's trying to give directions. If the teacher responds by raising his voice, are the students going to get quieter? No, probably not. They're probably going to talk even more, and they'll get louder. On the other hand, if the teacher purposefully lowers her voice after getting students' attention, the class will get quieter too. And that's why the best teachers often hardly have to raise their voices above a whisper. They've made amplifying feedback loops work in the right direction. When we have an amplifying feedback loop with negative consequences, we call that a vicious cycle. On the other hand, if we have an amplifying feedback loop that's positive, we call it a virtuous cycle. For example, when one person treats another person with respect, that respect tends to be reciprocated, and it creates a virtuous amplifying feedback loop that's good for everyone. Amplifying feedback loops happen at all levels and in every aspect of practice, including teacher motivation and enthusiasm. For example, let's say a particular lesson goes poorly, despite the teacher's best intentions and plans, and as a result, the teacher's discouraged and doesn't put the same energy into planning for the following day. What's likely to happen when the teacher doesn't plan as well? We can safely assume that this teacher is going to get stuck in a downward spiral. Poor planning leading to a poor lesson, leading to discouragement, leading to even more poor planning, and so on. Rigor and expectations form another classic example of an amplifying feedback loop. If you get stuck in a downward spiral of low rigor learning activities, students aren't going to be motivated, so they're not going to do very well. And that's going to further lower your expectations for what they can do, so you're going to continue to plan low rigor activities. But the spiral can go the other way, too, as you gain confidence in students' abilities to do rigorous work and plan more and more rigorous lessons as a result. Amplifying feedback loops help explain why there can be such huge differences between classrooms in the same school. You can have a group of kids go into one classroom, and those amplifying feedback loops run in a positive direction, and those virtuous cycles build on each other, and then that very same group of kids can go into another class where they've gotten stuck in negative amplifying feedback loops, and it's just chaos. I remember as a middle school science teacher, I'd often be asked to cover a class during my prep period when someone was out sick and we couldn't get a substitute, and sometimes that entire class would be my students who moved together from class to class because they had mostly the same schedule, and there would be huge differences in how those kids behaved depending on which class they were in, and it could go in either direction. Sometimes classes that I really struggled with in science would be incredible in, say, language arts class, even when I was teaching it, and I'd wonder, who are these kids? Why don't they act that way for me in my classroom? It's all the same people, you know? And in other cases, kids who'd work really hard and stay on task in my class would be terrible for me if I filled in for another teacher. So what are the implications of amplifying feedback loops for your work with teachers? Because they can swing things so far in one direction and so far in the opposite direction, diagnosing and fixing negative amplifying feedback loops is one of the highest leverage ways to bring about improvement. For example, if you can help a teacher who's not enjoying her job and whose kids don't like her turn that around and form great relationships with her students and really start to enjoy teaching again, how huge would that be? So we're not just chipping away at the tip of the iceberg here. When we identify amplifying feedback loops, we're getting at the deep underlying patterns that determine so much of what students are experiencing in the classroom. If you've ever felt like you have a teacher who's just hopeless, who has so much to work on, start here. Start by identifying the biggest amplifying feedback loops, and you'll see greater gains than with virtually anything else you could do. This can be life-changing, and what you share with the teacher doesn't even have to be that revolutionary if it pulls the teacher out of a vicious cycle. I'll never forget how my mentor teacher, Ann Fitzpatrick, worked with me as a brand new teacher when I was really struggling to get one particular class to listen. I was frustrated because kids weren't listening to my directions, and then when we did a science activity, they weren't following the directions, and then the activity would be a disaster, and then I'd say, well, I'm not doing that again. So I'd have a safer but less engaging lesson planned for the next day, giving students less motivation to listen, and I very quickly got trapped in a downward spiral. What Anne shared with me was a very simple strategy for getting students' attention. She modeled it for me simply by noticing the kids who were ready to learn and writing their names down on the screen without saying a word. And within a minute or so, she had the class's full attention. As a strategy, it wasn't anything special, and I didn't even use it for very long. But in that moment, it was exactly what I needed to break out of an amplifying feedback loop, a vicious cycle that was rapidly destroying my classroom. So with that one little strategy, she flipped that amplifying feedback loop, and I could give directions again. Kids could understand the directions again. I could plan fun, engaging lessons again. And I don't think it's any exaggeration to say that by seeing where I was stuck, by seeing that pattern, Anne saved my career. After working in different roles for the next few years, Anne and I later became principals at the same time, and Anne has continued to change the lives of thousands of teachers and students because one of her gifts is seeing the whole iceberg. And what I now realize is that professional practice isn't just about the people. It's not about the kids or the teachers or the parents or you or anyone else. It's not about blame. It's about patterns of cause and effect. And the biggest differences, positive or negative, come from those amplifying feedback loops. So I'd like to ask you now to think of two examples from your own experience. When have you seen a positive amplifying feedback loop or a virtuous cycle? And when have you seen a negative amplifying feedback loop or a vicious cycle in your work as an educator? Use the form below to share your examples, and I'll see you in the next section. The second learning dynamic is a dampening feedback loop. A dampening feedback loop is a pattern of cause and effect that tends to stabilize things. So unlike an amplifying feedback loop, which can very quickly cause dramatic changes, a dampening feedback loop is a subtle calming force that works against change. For example, if a student is talking while you're giving directions, you know a good strategy is to use proximity and move toward that student while you're giving directions. Because proximity creates a dampening feedback loop, that student will reduce their talking as you get closer. And that, in turn, reduces your need to continue moving toward the student. So you're not going to get up all the way in their face. The problem solves itself as that dampening feedback loop does its work. A lot of the subtle classroom management moves that are really effective and create a calm, productive environment work because they're dampening feedback loops. They give the teacher a way to respond to problems without escalating them. When you think about it, almost all communication can serve as a dampening feedback loop. Let's say a parent thinks the teacher is giving too much homework. If they email the teacher and the principal and complain, and the teacher reduces the amount of homework they're giving, and then the parent's probably going to stop complaining, and the teacher's probably going to keep the homework at that level. Just like amplifying feedback loops, dampening feedback loops aren't always positive. For example, the competency trap that we talked about in Module 3 is an example of a dampening feedback loop. When you try something new and you haven't yet climbed the learning curve, it's tempting to say, this isn't working as well as the old way, so I'm just going to give up and go back to the status quo. So dampening feedback loops can either keep things under control or keep us stuck in the same old status quo. It's the same pattern, and again, it's universal. It's not just that some people are stuck in their ways or that some teachers are good at responding to behavior problems without escalating them. Dampening feedback loops are a universal learning dynamic. And once we see how they work, we can do something about them. We can help teachers install dampening feedback loops when they need more effective ways to keep things under control, and we can help them break out of dampening feedback loops that are keeping them stuck in the status quo. I'd like you to think now of two examples of dampening feedback loops that you've encountered in your career as an educator. When have you seen dampening feedback loops that kept things stable and in a healthy range? And when have you seen a dampening feedback loop that kept someone stuck in the status quo? Use the form below to share your responses, and I'll see you in the next section. The third common learning dynamic is a delayed reaction. Delayed reactions are all around us. For example, something that happens in the hallway between classes may cause a student to disengage or act up during the lesson, even if at the start of the class that student seems fine. The fact that delayed reactions exist is obvious to us, but because schools are such busy places, they can often cause us to miss other patterns of cause and effect, especially since we're often in classrooms for just a brief period of time. So if you're having trouble figuring out which pattern is at work, consider the possibility of a delayed reaction. And the other patterns, such as amplifying or dampening feedback loops, may become obvious. For example, if you're observing a class discussion and you've been working with the teacher on facilitating higher order thinking, you may be wondering, what patterns of cause and effect are going on here? Maybe you don't see any amplifying or dampening feedback loops, but when you consider the possibility of a delayed reaction, you can start to identify them. For example, one common delayed reaction is the relationship between planning and preparation and how the lesson goes. If the teacher has thought through the discussion topic and has prepared really good questions that get students thinking at higher levels, that's going to have a delayed reaction, a good one. When you're in the classroom, you're not going to see the work that went into preparing those questions, but you will see the delayed reaction in the form of a really good discussion. And just like the first two patterns, delayed reactions can be positive or negative. A teacher who hasn't planned good discussion questions in advance will probably have a hard time facilitating that higher order thinking. Another common example of a delayed reaction dynamic is relationships. When you're observing in a classroom, A big part of why people are acting the way they are is because of relationships that have been formed over time. Kids will work really hard for teachers that they have a good relationship with, even if the teaching techniques that the teacher is using are nothing special. Think about it. We've all had teachers that we loved, that we did great work for, even though they used what we'd now consider to be very outdated teaching strategies. So as you're trying to see the whole iceberg of teacher practice, as you're trying to see the big picture, keep in mind, a lot of what you see is a consequence of what has happened in the past. And again, when I say it that way, it's obvious, but we've been trained as instructional leaders to focus on technique, to always look for an immediate cause. And when we can't find it, we tend to commit the fundamental attribution error and blame the teacher rather than the action they took that originally caused the result we're seeing. Blaming the teacher triggers defensiveness, and instead of having a calm, productive discussion about practice, we start to lock horns with the teacher. This itself is an example of an amplifying feedback loop, and not a good one. So we need to keep in mind that we're not seeing the whole iceberg when we show up in the classroom. Cause and effect are often separated in time. For example, let's say I'm observing a lesson and it's just a mess. It's disorganized and the kids are confused and the teacher's frustrated and time is being wasted. I'm probably going to notice something that the teacher could be doing that they're not doing, and I'm going to want to focus my feedback on that. For example, let's say I notice that the teacher doesn't talk about what they did yesterday and doesn't link up today's assignment to what students have been working on. I might be tempted to give the teacher feedback on that because I think it's something that she should do. But what if that's not the real issue? It may be that the teacher didn't have enough time to plan today's lesson because they had a sick family member that they had to take to the hospital yesterday. But if I forget about that delayed reaction dynamic, I'm going to have a tendency to look for an immediate cause that I can see right in front of me. And I might either give feedback that doesn't address the real problem, or worse, I might commit the fundamental attribution error and assume this teacher just isn't any good. The delayed reaction dynamic helps us understand why it's so important to talk with teachers and get their perspective before we draw any conclusions. We never see the whole iceberg of teacher practice when we're just observing a lesson, and it's only through conversation that we can start to get a sense of what's beneath the surface. So now it's your turn. When have you made the assumption that you saw cause and effect in a lesson, only to realize later that the real cause happened before you showed up? When has the delayed reaction dynamic affected your feedback to a teacher? Use the form below to let me know, and I'll see you in the next section. So we've talked about amplifying feedback loops, dampening feedback loops, and delayed reactions, and that brings us to the fourth learning dynamic, which is side effects, or unintended consequences. Now, we've all heard of side effects, so it's not a new concept to anyone, but let's think about how being on the lookout for unintended consequences can help us better see the whole iceberg of teacher practice. All biological systems, such as the human body, have ways of maintaining stability or homeostasis, and those are essentially dampening feedback loops. For example, if you get too hot, you start to sweat, and sweating cools you off, and when you're cool enough, you stop sweating. Most of the time, it works great. But these stabilizing forces can also create problems. For example, if you sweat so much that you become dehydrated, that can cause your temperature to spike. These side effects of good systems are always something that we have to keep an eye out for, so that in solving one problem, we don't unwittingly create an even bigger problem. Let's take a common dynamic between students, teachers, and administrators. If a teacher sends a student to the office for a discipline issue, that might have a dampening or stabilizing effect in the short term. The student is out of the classroom, the rest of the class can get back to work, and the teacher doesn't get into an escalating power struggle or an amplifying feedback loop with the student. But what side effects might we need to consider? Often, one side effect of sending a student to the office is that the teacher is giving up power. The student starts to see the administrator, rather than the teacher, as the authority, and they may start to lose respect for that teacher. This can kick off an amplifying feedback loop of disrespect for the teacher and can quickly sour the student's relationship with the teacher. So relationship side effects are one of the most common types, and often that's a good thing. The more positive experiences we have with each other, the more trust we'll build, not because we are setting out to build trust, but because it's a natural side effect of working together. Again, the concept of side effects is familiar to everyone, so I'm not going to belabor it. But by now, you can see just how much complexity there is in a typical classroom. We've been conditioned to think that teaching is a matter of techniques and strategies and best practices, and that if we just use the right ones, everything will be great. But we know that's not really true. We know teaching is also an art. And if you gave me a choice between a teacher who used all the right strategies and a teacher who had mastered the art, I'd take the artful teacher any day of the week. The challenge for us as instructional leaders is helping teachers master that art. Layering on random strategies, chipping away at the tip of the iceberg, isn't going to get us there. We've got to see the whole iceberg, and learning dynamics can help us do just that. They can occur in any combination of feedback loops and delays and unintended consequences, and there are even more that we haven't talked about in this module. But if you want to change teacher practice, you've got to be able to see that practice clearly and talk about it in ways that don't trigger teachers' natural resistance and defensiveness. So instead of talking about the teacher and making the fundamental attribution error and playing the blame game, I want to challenge you to start talking about the dynamics. Focus on the patterns of cause and effect, and you'll find that when you do, teachers take it a lot less personally. Because they'll recognize those patterns as universal and as something outside of themselves, they'll have a much greater sense of agency and a much greater belief in their own ability to change patterns that aren't working. That's it for now on Learning Dynamics. I'm Justin Bader, and I'll see you in the next section. Now let's talk about how to combine what you've learned in this module about learning dynamics with the three kinds of feedback that we discussed in Module 3. When you're talking with a teacher, you can play one or more of three roles. First, you can play the boss role and tell the teacher what you want to happen using directive feedback. Second, you can play the coach and ask the teacher reflective questions to get them thinking about their practice. And third, you can play the leader and use a reflexive approach to both give and receive feedback in your conversations with teachers. So how can you use learning dynamics in each of these feedback roles? When you're using directive feedback, learning dynamics can help you share your rationale with teachers in a much more specific and convincing way. Too often, we use rationales like it's best practice or it's research-based, and we ignore the often good reasons that teachers are doing what they're doing. For example, if you want a teacher to stop raising his voice and find more subtle ways to get students' attention, you can combine an expectation with an explanation. For example, you might say, "In this school, we don't yell at our kids, and I want you to understand what happens when you do. When you're yelling, you can't hear students, so they talk even more, and they're also losing respect for you." Now, you don't have to say to the teacher that yelling creates a negative amplifying feedback loop, or that losing students' respect is an example of an unintended consequence, but you do want to help teachers see the patterns that you see. Remember the Johari window concept that we talked about in the introduction to this module? We all have blind spots about ourselves, things that other people can see that we don't realize about ourselves until someone tells us. Getting that feedback is often really tough and often triggers our worst defensive reactions. If you tell me my students don't respect me because I yell, I might get really defensive and shut down. But if you help me understand the cause and effect dynamic and help me realize that it's a universal pattern and not a personal character flaw, I can listen and I can change that pattern. Second, how can you use learning dynamics with reflective feedback? In Module 3, you learned about the practice awareness continuum, which helps teachers move from domain aware to performance aware to impact aware to skill aware. And the sweet spot for most instructional leaders is helping teachers understand the impact their instruction is having on students. In other words, our greatest opportunity is in helping teachers move from performance aware to impact aware. To help you ask good reflective questions, I've provided a PDF below of my 10 best questions for having evidence-based conversations. These questions will help you get at all four types of learning dynamics, as well as others that we haven't even talked about yet. Finally, how can learning dynamics help you engage in reflexive feedback? Ultimately, wearing the leader hat is a matter of taking on greater responsibility for the whole system in which teachers do their work. As we've seen, W. Edwards Deming said that 94% of the opportunities for improvement lie not in the practice of individuals, but in the functioning of the system. So the key to taking advantage of learning dynamics at the system level is to look for ways that those dynamics are playing out beyond the walls of an individual classroom. If you discover amplifying or dampening feedback loops or delayed reactions or unintended side effects at the school level, be open to the possibility that the best way to bring about an improvement in one classroom is to change something outside of that classroom at the system level. Now, obviously, we don't want to get teachers into the habit of complaining about things that are outside of their control, but we do want everyone to take responsibility for the parts of the whole that they are legitimately responsible for. And that includes ourselves. If we discover through a reflexive feedback conversation that we need to make a change, it's time to step up and make it happen. For example, we had an anti-bullying curriculum that all teachers were expected to teach every year in my school. And one year, I realized that it just wasn't happening in kindergarten. And I said to the teachers, you know, isn't this something that we've agreed to do? And they said, yes. And they said, we'll try to work on it. But it's usually very hard to find time. Now, I could have dismissed that as complaining, and we did have an especially challenging group of kids that year, so teachers certainly could have put part of the blame on students. But in reality, the problem was with our schedule. I had moved things around a bit and left teachers with far too little time in between afternoon recess and when they went to their other classes like music and PE. So teachers now had 15 minutes in between instead of 30, and that made it just about impossible for them to teach that anti-bullying curriculum. And to their great credit, they weren't afraid to tell me that, and we came up with a very simple solution. For that afternoon recess, kindergarten would just go out at the same time as fifth grade, which we had never done before, but it worked great because they had buddy classes anyway. A simple schedule change, and everything worked out, because we had a reflexive feedback conversation that allowed us to see the whole system. So I don't know exactly what you'll notice in your particular school, but I do know that these patterns are universal. Amplifying feedback loops, dampening feedback loops, delayed reactions, and unintended consequences. They can work in an infinite number of combinations, but that complexity doesn't have to overwhelm us. Instead, when we know what to look for, it can focus us and help us provide the right feedback at the right time and take advantage of the biggest opportunities for improvement, both within and beyond the classroom. I'm Justin Bader, and I'll see you in the next section. Now it's time to give Learning Dynamics a test drive in your next conversation with a teacher. So here's what I want you to do. You'll notice that this is the same as your Module 3 Action Challenge, but with a new twist. Visit a classroom for a brief, informal visit, no more than 10 or 15 minutes, and look for the four learning dynamics we've talked about in this module. Don't just look at what the teacher is doing and what the students are doing. Try to find the patterns, the links between what's happening beneath the surface and what you can actually see above the surface. If you're still in your second cycle of visits, don't take any notes while you're in the classroom, just pay attention. Then after you leave, get another sheet of paper and divide it up like the iceberg, using about 20% of the page for your above the waterline direct observations, what you could see, and 80% for those beneath the surface factors, the causes in those cause and effect loops and delayed reactions. Look for amplifying loops, dampening feedback loops, delayed reactions, and unintended consequences. But then, most importantly, talk with the teacher. You can't truly see the patterns until you have a conversation, because so much of the work of teaching happens beneath the surface. And figure out, in that conversation, whether you're better off playing the boss role, the coach role, or the leader role, and adjust your approach accordingly. And when you've done that, come back here and let me know how it went. What did you learn from talking with the teacher? What learning dynamics did you uncover? What type of feedback, directive, reflective, or reflexive, did you focus on? Let me know. And when you've done that, you've completed Module 4. Congratulations, and I'll see you in Module 5.